Last Night, opening at UNM, is a production presented by the UNM Department of Theater and Dance. And Then They Came For Me, Remembering the World of Anne Frank, is a multimedia theater piece retelling the stories of three teens in hiding during the Holocaust. And it's been acclaimed by audiences and critics and worldwide productions. And what makes it very special is that for this production, which audiences have the opportunity to see this weekend and next, and we'll give details later on, is the presence at each performance of the woman who helped create this piece. And what makes it really special for me and for all of you listening is that Eva Schloss joins us today in the studio. Eva was a friend, a neighbor of Anne Frank. Both of their families, as it turned out, went into hiding the very same day. And it was on Eva's 15th birthday in 1944, just after she and her mother moved to a new hiding place when they were arrested by the Nazis. And there began a journey of unimaginable horror and cruelty. Both Eva and her mother were sent to Auschwitz, Birkenau. Both survived. And Eva now, I'll have to ask her, but about 81 years old, has devoted her life to educating people around the world about the importance of tolerance and respect for differences. And Eva, I'm really honored to welcome you today. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And also with us is Susan Pearson. She's a professor of theater in the Department of Theater and Dance at UNM. She has overseen the theater education and outreach curriculum and has taught courses in children's theater, creative drama, and theater for education and social change, as well as acting and voice. Susan is a past president of the American Alliance for Theater and Education and the winner some years ago of an Albuquerque Arts Alliance Bravo Award as Arts Educator of the Year. She has directed numerous productions at UNM and is the director for this production, And Then They Came For Me, Remembering the World of Anne Frank. And something, Susan, I discovered by poking around on the web last night, which I didn't know, Susan is actually retiring after 27 years of teaching and directing. I had no idea about this until yesterday. And following tomorrow's matinee performance is a retirement reception to celebrate her.
Yes.
So congratulations
to you. Thank
you
so much, Carol.
And before we talk to Eva, what I want to do is ask you why you chose this piece to mark your farewell.
Well, you know, I had seen this piece in the year 2000 at a conference in Chicago produced by Northwestern University. And I went in to it knowing the playwright. I knew the playwright, and he had been here as a guest artist with playwriting in the school's program called Wrinkle Writing that I headed for some years. And James Still, who's the author, had told the students, the children who were at his workshop, about the challenges of writing different kinds of material. And he had finished this play within the last couple years before he came to see us. And he remembered the challenges and the joys of talking to Eva and the other survivor whose story is featured in this play, and putting together video and putting together actors. And I went, wow, I'm definitely going to see this play when I have a chance. I went in thinking I knew a lot about the Holocaust, realized I hardly knew anything, and I learned so much from that one play. And then Eva got up. I didn't even know she was in the audience. They brought her up on stage, and I was just so moved by her presence that it went on the, you know, in my bucket list of those things I want to direct before I retire, and don't have the resources of the university's theater program to support the technology aspect of the play.
Well, this is quite a performance to go out on, I would say.
It is. It's very rich, and I've learned so much, and the students have learned so much. Just amazing.
So what was the opening like last night? Last night was the first
full
performance.
House, and when Eva came up on the stage, standing ovation. It was great.
It was really a very, very powerful production. I've seen productions all over the world, you know, and some are good, some are less good.
But with a lot of heart, probably.
Yes, yes. But this was really, really very moving and excellent.
Well, I think I read somewhere that you must have seen, and this was written a few years ago, what I read, you've probably seen hundreds of performances.
Oh, definitely, definitely, yes. In Australia, in Germany, in Latvia, in England, really all over. But But of course, as it's an American play, it has been performed, I think, nearly in all the states here.
You can't possibly go to all of the performances.
I've been to many, many. Of course, not to all, because at the moment now, I know they are in two different places as well in the States, which is the place going on. Of course, I can only be in one place, and I chose to come to New Mexico because James Still recommended Susan, especially as a wonderful director.
Well, how did you get involved with the production, Eva? I mean, you helped create this with James.
Well, I got in 1995, I got a phone call from Susan Kerner, who was working in a theater in New Jersey, that they've commissioned a playwright to write a new play about the Holocaust. And it's still supposed to be a little bit about Anne Frank, but people knew the Anne Frank stories. They wanted to know about different Holocaust survivors, about children who had their own story. So they contacted me and Ed Silverberg, who was one of Anne's first boyfriends, and asked me if I would like to participate with this project about a play about partly my life. And I always imagine things as a film in front of my eye, because you know what happened in Auschwitz and afterwards even, I could never get out of my mind. So I really hoped it would be shared once with a wide audience. So I was very keen to participate with this project. And James came over. He interviewed me for several days. He went to Amsterdam to research. And then he wrote six scripts. He always sent it to me. And I adjusted certain things, gave him different ideas. And so it came to happen that it was performed in New Jersey in 1996 for the first time.
So that was 1996, and here we are many years later, still being produced around the world. How has it evolved for you as someone who has participated in the creation, and you are part of this production in terms of the interviews? How has it evolved in terms of you as a viewer, for which, of course, this is highly personal, from 1996 to now, 2011?
Well, it is amazing, and I'm amazed, and most people are amazed, and how long the Holocaust is in the past, how more people get interested. And I mean, there are new young people growing up all the time who didn't know anything about it. And before, perhaps the grandparents were still involved, knowing something, having told something to the young people. But now it seems to that's the only way they can learn from survivors who are still around. And as we are getting older, and many of them are not anymore able to talk about it, it is important that we tell the story to the young people, because they will be the people who will carry on the story for us.
Well, you're talking about older people who are no longer able to tell the story. There are many people, and it sounds like you are one of them, and very understandably so, who could not speak about this for many, many years. I mean, you talk about unspeakable horrors, and it took you, it seems, about almost 40 years.
Yes.
Which would be what, the 1980s?
Yes, that's right. It was actually 1986. You know, in Amsterdam, the Anne Frank House had become a museum, and the people there were many historians. They put up different exhibitions and history lessons, and there were young people coming from all over the world to hear lectures about what had happened. But they realized not everybody can come to Amsterdam, and they decided they would make a traveling exhibition. And that came to the first time to London in 1986. And Otto had died by that. Otto was my mother's second husband and Anne's father, and he was 17 years older than my mother, but he died in 1980. And of course, my mother was invited, and me. And then the organizer asked me to come and sit at the head table, at the opening. There were about 200 people. It was the first time anything like that had been shown in London, England, altogether. And after everybody spoke movingly, it was Ken Livingston, who was the mayor of London at the time, and he said, and now Eva will want to say a few words. Well, I can tell you, I wanted to crawl under the table. I was not ready to speak, not at all about anything, but certainly not about the Holocaust. I'd been a very shy person from after the war, because, you know, if you were told always you are like vermin, you are not worth living, I'd lost all my confidence. And so there I stood in front of 200 people looking up expectantly, and after a few minutes silence, I started to tell everything what I'd suppressed for 40 years and their difficulty stopping me.
Oh, that had to be extraordinary for the audience and for you. My goodness.
That was really a watershed for me.
Yes,
from
I imagine.
Then on, my life changed.
Yes. You know, let me first tell listeners, if you just tuned in, this is Women's Focus. My name is Carol Boss, hosting this week. And in the studio with me is Eva Schloss, who you just heard. And Eva is a Holocaust survivor, and she is in Albuquerque because a production, which opened last night at UNM, University of New Mexico, and will be running next weekend as well. It's called Then They Came, for me, Remembering the World of Anne Frank. And it's a multimedia theater piece. And there are performances. Is tonight sold out, Susan?
I don't know. They did say ticket sales were brisk.
And I bet they are, and I bet they'll be brisk after this as well. So let me just say, so we had the performance last night, and there'll be a performance this evening at 7:30. There's a matinee tomorrow afternoon at 2 o'clock. And same schedule next week, Friday.
There's also a Thursday night performance next week.
Oh, is there? Mm-hmm. Thursday, Friday, Saturday. Susan, you said Saturday next week is sold out. So it'll be Thursday, Friday, and Sunday.
Saturday is Sunday. Sunday matinee at 2.
Yeah, so at 2.
Evenings at 7:30.
And I'll repeat this again later on, but you can go to theater, theatre.unm.edu. to find out about tickets, or call 277-4332. And online, you can also go to www.unmtickets.com. So saying to you, Eva, before we went on air, that I think this is an extraordinary opportunity to have you in the studio today, and that there might be, there probably are some listeners who have never had a firsthand experience of listening to the stories of someone who is a survivor of the Holocaust. So I wanted you to talk about your background. I know you were born in Austria. Your family lived there. Your father had a shoemaking factory.
That's right. And we had a very good life with many relatives, and we were comfortably off. My father was a daredevil. He was a very big sportsman, and he was one of the first people who bought a car. And you know, Austria is very mountainous, and he went up with us sitting in the back, those serpentine roads, and my mother sitting screaming next to him. And you know, and I was like him. I loved sport and outdoor life and skiing and swimming, and I was very, very happy. But all this really collapsed suddenly when in 1938 the Nazis marched in and were welcomed by the Austrian people. And immediately life changed for us. People turned on us. So before, we had mixed with many non-Jewish people. But from then on, we were outcasts and were attacked in the street. And life really became very, very difficult and dangerous. But we were lucky, we were able to get out. Many of our relatives were not able to get visas to leave the country. And it wasn't that Hitler didn't want to let us out. It was that the other countries didn't want to let us in. That was really the tragedy of the Holocaust, that Jewish people desperately wanted to find a safe haven, and there wasn't anything. So eventually, we ended up in Holland, in Amsterdam.
This is after being in several other places.
Yes, in Belgium first, and then eventually in Holland. And We moved to a big square, the Mervedeplein, where some other refugees lived. And it was an open space, and all the children came out to play there. And one day, a little girl came to me and introduced herself, very polite, and told me she was Anne Frank and came from Germany as well. And I couldn't speak Dutch very well, and she took me up to her apartment to meet her family.
So you live close by?
Opposite each other. And so we became friends. We were both 11 years old. And we saw each other after school nearly every day, and we played, you know, like young kids did, skipping and hopscotch and gossiping about the other children. And but Anne wasn't my type, really. You know, I was, as I say, I was a wild child, a tomboy, and Anne was a real girl, very sophisticated, very interested in her clothes and her hairstyle, and as well in boys. I had a brother who was 3 years older than me, so boys came all the time in the house, so there was no mystery about boys. But Anne was fascinated with boys. She had an older sister, same age as my brother, Margot. And so she was quite a big flirt, and I didn't go in for this kind of thing. As I say, I was a bit a late developer as well, you know. And but again, life changed in May 1940 when the Germans attacked Holland. And it was a very short war, just 5 days, and the Dutch gave in. And then the same thing happened like in Austria, the measures against the Jewish population. The difference was, of course, that the Dutch didn't welcome the Nazis and the Germans. There was soon formed a big resistance movement. People who fought the Nazis, they blew up trains and shot particular wicked Nazis, and they printed ration cards, and they made false ID cards for people who were going to go into hiding. So for 2 years we lived in fear that people of our family would be arrested. And then in June 1942, many young people got a call-up notice to go to work in Germany. And many parents sent their children because they thought, well, they're young, the Germans need people to work. But Otto and my father and many others didn't send their young people. That was my brother Heinz and Anne's sister Margot. And we went into hiding.
So at that point, the Jews were wearing the stars.
That's right.
And if a Jewish person didn't wear a star, how would they be known to be Jews? You know where I thought of this question, because I saw an interview online with middle school students, and one of the young people asked that question.
Well, we were registered, you know, and that was part of the, it was called Yotzerat. It was the Nazis asked Jewish people to register all the Jews. And this was really very, very sad. In Holland, actually, the biggest proportion of Jewish people were rounded up because they were all registered. But besides that, all our documents had a J on it. So, even in Austria and in Germany, you know, very often children ask me, how did people know you were a Jew? First of all, in school, you had to have religious education. Austria was a Catholic country, so the Catholic children stayed in their class. The Jewish children were taken out. We had Jewish education. So it was even before Hitler. So everybody knew who was a Jew. And besides that, you had to register at your local religious community. So Jewish people had to register at their synagogues, Catholic at their churches, and so on. And the Nazis could just go to those institutions and see where people lived and where they were and who they were. So it was all very, very well organized.
So your family decided to go in Holland, and I mean into hiding, and the situation was such that you really could not, for security purposes, even tell probably your closest friends that you were going to do that.
No, because, as I said, there were Dutch Nazis as well, and you didn't know who might betray you.
Right.
And it was difficult, you know, the Dutch don't live in houses in the towns, so in apartments which are rather small. And so nobody wanted to take in four people, so we had to split up there. I went with my mother, and my brother went with my father in hiding.
So how did you discover what were the hiding places? Is this through the Dutch underground? That
through people from the resistance, which my father had planned before. We didn't know. We didn't tell us. You know, they kept the children ignorant because they didn't want to worry us. So we didn't know. But then when this call-up notice came, my father said, now it's time to disappear. And he had obviously spoken to people who he'd known and who were willing to take us in.
Well, you know, at that point, were you 15 yet at that?
No, I was 13.
You were 13, so there was 2 years of hiding. Well, at that point, when you first went into hiding and your father said, this is what we need to do, what did you, as a young teenager, what did you think of that? And beforehand, how concerned were you about what was going to be the ultimate situation for your family?
Well, you know, children take things quite different from adults. Parents protected us, and we were upset that we couldn't go to the cinema, that we couldn't play with our friends, we couldn't visit them at home. But we didn't realize, till we went into hiding, in what danger we really were. Because, you know, we felt we were ordinary people, so mm-hmm. why should anybody kill us? You know, that was incomprehensible for us, really.
Was it frightening to you then?
But once we went into hiding, and as I say, I was a very outdoor child, I found it extremely difficult to sit still. At that time, I didn't like reading or anything like that, and, you know, to be cooped up. But at that time, we all thought the war will be finished very soon. Nobody expected the war would drag on and drag on. So when we separated, my father said, well, just a few months and then we'll be free again. So, and, you know, unfortunately, for 2 years we were in hiding. We had to change very often hiding places because the Nazis did house searches. They were looking for the people who hadn't appeared. And so the people became scared. There was, for instance, a story went round. Usually at night they came and they felt the beds of the people who had been hiding there because we had hiding places within our hiding place. The people from the resistance came and looked over the apartment and said, well, here we make a false partition or there is room under the floorboard or in a cupboard or things like that. And so in this particular case, they felt the beds who were still warm and they demolished the whole hiding place till they found the people. And the people, the Dutch people who helped us, were taken to concentration camps as well. So, of course, very often people said after several months, you know, we just can't take the tension any longer. You have to look for a different hiding place. So we changed about 7 times different places.
Yeah, I was reading that there was a partition that was built, which I don't quite understand, inside a toilet.
Well, it was inside a long bathroom.
Yes.
And there was a bath, a wash basin, and a toilet. And they separated the toilet. They made a partition so that it would just be a bathroom with a sink, but not a toilet, because that was at the end of the bathroom. And so with a tiled trapdoor, which you put in once we were in the toilet part. But of course, you could see a little seam, but otherwise it couldn't be put in. So each time and it happened nearly every week that they came to search.
Wow.
So each time, you know, we sat there really,
oh my goodness,
desperately afraid they would find us.
Wow. And there was at least one time, right, when you managed to get behind a trap door and it was just like moments before there was the knock on the door.
Yeah.
Wow, wow, wow. This is Women's Focus that you're in tune to. My name is Carol Boss, and joining me in the studio today is Eva Schloss, and she is, she has, wow, the survivor of the Holocaust And she is in Albuquerque, if you didn't hear me say so before, because of a production that opened last night. And then they came for me, Remembering the World of Anne Frank. It's a multimedia theater piece that includes filmed interview with Eva and also Ed Silverberg, who is, as Eva said before, one of the first boyfriends of Anne Frank. And Susan Pearson is with us. She is the a professor of theater. Not for much longer. She's having a retirement reception tomorrow.
Yes.
And this production, and what's very special also as well, we mentioned that Eva spoke after last night's performance. Well, she's going to be here all through the entire run of the production,
speaking
afterwards. So this is an amazing opportunity to meet her, to hear her speak. Do you take questions and answers?
Yes, that's correct. People have, of course, you know, as I say, the play talks about many things but not goes into a lot of details, and people want to know more about it.
Susan, you said you've, in being involved with this production, that you've learned a whole lot about the Holocaust that you didn't know, and you thought you knew a whole lot. Tell us something that was new information for you, revelatory.
Immediately we got a hold of Eva's books, because the actress and the actors who play her and her brother and father and sister use that as primary research. So her book, Eva's Story, and the other one, The Promise, were parts of our research. And I think one of the amazing things was her journey. The chapters that were written about being in the camp were just unimaginable. But then her mother and she, to get home after the Auschwitz was liberated by the Russians, had such an amazing journey. It was not a safe or easy journey to return home through, what, five countries and with no money.
Didn't realize the travail, how extensive.
No, I guess I just figured that somehow everybody got out and went home like they could today, get in a car and go somewhere.
Well, I'm going to ask Eva about that. I want to hear what must have been, surely was a harrowing story of when you were finally captured and arrested. And was it truly on your birthday?
Yes, it really happened.
May
11th.
May 11th.
1944.
How old are you now? Are you going to be 81 or 82?
I'll be going to be 82.
So you're 81 and 7/8 years old, something like that.
Yeah.
So what was that day like? What happened?
Well, we just changed hiding place. We had just been there a few days, so we didn't have yet a hiding place within the hiding place. But anyway, we were betrayed by a Dutch nurse. And even if we would have had a hiding place, they would have found us.
So you betrayed in the sense that she portrayed herself as someone who was helping you with this new hiding place?
Yeah, it was really, my father and brother had to change hiding place as well, because the person where they were staying blackmailed them for more money. And after we had been in hiding already for 2 years, my father had sold jewelry, but we didn't have much left. So he said, I must move, because if our money runs out, she'll throw us out anyway. And so we got in, because they were in the country, and my mother and me were in Amsterdam. So my mother got in touch with people from the resistance to ask for a new hiding place for my father and brother. By that time, it was already very difficult to find safe places, because many people from the resistance had to go into hiding as well. And as well, by that time, they picked up a lot of Dutch young men, not Jewish, to go and work in Germany in forced labor, to work in the factories. And of course, they didn't want to go, so a lot of Dutch people went into hiding as well. So it was very difficult, and so eventually a Dutch nurse came forward and said she knew a safe place, and she was really a double agent. She really worked for the Nazis, and this is how my father and brother and we were betrayed.
So There was a knock on the door.
Yeah, we were just going down to breakfast and was just going to get my presents. And they stormed in and just took us away.
Mm-hmm.
And at that time, we knew exactly what was the punishment. Because people had been in hiding, you got an S stamped on your papers. So that was even worse than a normal Jew. And we knew we were going to send to a death camp. So at that time, I really thought, you know, within a few days, my life would end. So that was, of course, a very frightening idea.
Yeah, it's incomprehensible, really, for most people.
Yeah.
You know, you... before you were talking about how, you know, as being an active child, of course, it was very hard for you to be in confinement, not be able to go out and play, not be able to see friends, whatever would be part of your normal life. Was there anything that you and your mother were able to do that kept your spirit intact? What was it that...
Well, in the camp, you know, I was 15 years old, and...
But before you got to the camp?
Oh, before
just,
we got
just
to
in
the
hiding.
Camp. No, well, oh, in hiding. Well, just patient, you know. No, there wasn't really much we could do.
Did you read? Did you write?
Well, my mother taught me a bit of schoolwork. A teacher was well from the resistance. He brought books to keep me up to date with, so that I wouldn't lose so many years schooling. But it was very frustrating. And I had so much energy. And, you know, we had some little fights. I had some fights with my mother just to get out a bit, rid of some energy. But, you know, it was the boredom. And as well, being frightened at night. You know, you never slept properly because they were going to knock and you had to disappear and go into your hiding place. And, you know, so it was, but nothing, of course, compared with what was waiting us when we got to Auschwitz.
Mm-hmm. So they, when they arrested you, they took you to what?
To the headquarters.
Gestapo headquarters.
Yes. And they wanted to know who were the people from the resistance who helped us with, we had false ID cards and ration cards, and they wanted to know. And as I was the youngest, they thought for me they will get out the information. So they really beat me up.
Physically beat you up?
Yes, tried to get information. But I knew the people who had helped us. I knew, but it was not, I didn't know their real name. I didn't know where they lived. So luckily I couldn't betray anybody.
Were you beaten up in front of your mother?
Yes. And then I were told that I didn't know that my father and brother were arrested as well. Then they told us that, you know, they are here as well. And they were going to, they realized how attached I was to my brother. They said they were going to kill him if I'm not going to give them information.
And for but, you, that had to be unbearable.
But as I say, you know,
I couldn't betray anything. Right.
Which was good. And they realized eventually that I knew nothing.
Mm-hmm.
So they let me go.
And then how much longer before they put you on a train?
Well, we were first in an ordinary prison one night, and then we were sent to a holding camp. And there we were just two nights. And then we were put on a cattle truck. And didn't tell us where we were going, but Holland is the most western country, so eastward was bad news, whatever. And there was a horrendous journey, of course, with 100 people pushed into a terrible small space without air, just with two buckets for water and toilets. People fainted. And eventually we arrived. It was a beautiful May day. And we had to jump out of the train, and we saw the sign Auschwitz, Auschwitz in Polish. And we knew this was a huge, huge, huge death camp with gas chambers, because the BBC had told always on their broadcast to all, they sent broadcast to all the occupied countries in their own languages. And so we knew about that, about the gas chambers. So again, at that point, men and women were separated. So that is the last time I saw my father and brother. And
so you did see them when you arrived, when you first arrived?
Yes, well, we were together in the train.
Oh, you were, okay.
Yes. And then first selection took place, which meant that all young people, babies, little children, and older people, according to how you looked, could have been 45, 50, and people who looked pale or, you know, very tired from the journey or stooped or whatever, they went to one side and the others went to the other side. At that time, of course, we didn't realize what it meant. And they had as well a trick. They said, it's about a 10-minute walk into the camp. We have got trucks here. And if you're tired, you can go on the truck. And even some young people said, well, you know, they were tired. Why should I walk? They went on this truck and those went straight to the guest chambers. But again, we didn't know that, of course. And then we entered the camp and in a big barrack, undressed completely naked. We were tattooed, all our hair was shaved, and while all this was going on, they told us what had happened to the family we have been separated from. That, you know, they were going to go to a shower, they were given a towel and soap, and they were waiting. There were pipes with shower heads, but nothing happened, and people started to have breathing difficulty and faint and collapsed on the floor. And they were telling us with much pleasure. And you can imagine how people felt who had just given up their child.
Mm.
And then it was our turn to go into the shower. Of course, we didn't want to go. We were beaten into it.
Were you with your mother at this point?
Yeah, we were still together.
Uh-huh.
And we stood there clinging to each other. And we really thought the last hours, last minutes have come to our life on earth. But water came out. So that was, of course, an immense relief.
Wow. That's, yeah. So at some point you were separated from your mother, weren't you?
Yeah. Again, at another, about after 4 months having been in the camp, after going to a shower, there stood Mengele. Again, we were naked. We had to parade in front of him. And he looked us over and my mother had very often given me a piece of her bread, and she had become very, very thin. We were all very thin, but she was particularly thin. And about 40 women were picked out of our group and were taken out to a death block to be waiting for another transport when they were going to be gassed. So, and our group was taken to a different part of the camp, and I assumed I'd lost my mother. That was for me the hardest time in the camp.
So
thinking that, you know, not knowing that it happened to my father and brother, you know, this is what was really awful.
It's hard for me, as it is, I'm sure, for most people to comprehend what anyone, and here, a young 15, maybe 16-year-old, going through all of this. How did you deal with this at the point when you assumed your mother had been killed?
Well, that was the point when I really nearly wanted to give up.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, the only time when you can had a chance to survive really is if you didn't give up. Because physically, your body was so weak and you know, didn't really function properly. It was winter by then, and I had terrible frostbite on my feet, and I was starving, and, you know, it was really... But again, another miracle happened. One day, my father appeared. That was really... And, of course, I never could ask how he was able to come. He came with his SS boss, and he told me that my brother was still alive. But unfortunately, I told him as well that my mother was dead. Because that was, he asked, of course, where my mother was, and I had to tell him. And he came 3 times to see me, and then I never ever saw him again. And he perished, of course, and I feel sometimes very guilty about that, because he was such a strong person. And I think my brother probably died first, and he didn't think I would have survived on my own. He thought his wife was dead, and I think he just gave up. If he would have known that his wife had not been killed, you know, he might have perhaps had the strength to survive.
Mm-hmm. So when was it that you discovered your mother was alive and saw her
that
again?
That was end of December, when a lot of Germans had taken a lot of inmates out of the camp because they knew the Russians were approaching. It wasn't so strict anymore. The gas chambers, the crematorium had been blown up. They didn't want to leave any marks of what has happened there. And the camp became smaller and smaller. And in middle of January, we woke up one day, and it was very quiet, and the Germans had gone. They had fled with most of the inmates. There were only about 300 women left in our part of the camp. And I was at that time reunited again with my mother.
Wow. An amazing surprise, wasn't it?
It was. But at that time, we still didn't. We were very, very skeletons and very weak. And it was one of the coldest winters on record, you know. And we had no food. And there was no water. There was a little pond outside. We had to hack water for ice. And many people still died because, you know, they were too weak and too ill. And I was one of the few people who had to help carry out the dead bodies. We couldn't bury them. We had to heap them up behind the barracks. It was really horrible. And we didn't know, were the Germans coming back? Were the Russians coming? What were the Russians going to do with that? It was really a very uncertain time. But then after about 10 days being in uncertainty, the first Russians came. And then more came, and they put up a field kitchen and fed us. But cabbage soup, that was their staple food. And it went right through our bodies. And the next day, many people had died because the effort for the body, who was so weak to digest, was just too much. And people just died. So, and then we decided we would try to go to the men camp and try to find my father and brother. So we went there, and we met 2 people who we had known from Amsterdam, and one of them was Otto Frank. And, of course, the first question was, have you seen my family? And we asked as well if he had seen my father and brother. And he had seen them, but he said they are not here anymore. So we still had great hope. And then the Russians decided, there was fierce fighting going on, that they wouldn't leave us in Auschwitz, but they would transport us eastwards because we couldn't go home because it was still war going on in January. Europe was only, the war was finished in May. So we traveled for 4 months eastward with the Russians, always in trains. It was still cattle trucks because that was the way they traveled. Even the army traveled that way. Sometimes we stopped off somewhere where they could billet us into an empty building. But the devastation I saw through the whole of Russia and Ukraine and Poland and Romania was unbelievable. The Germans had burned down every house, every field, there was just nothing. And the Russian army consisted of lots of young boys who had lost everything in their villages. They had no uniform, no weapons, but they were just pursuing the Nazis and going to revenge themselves in Germany, which they did. But us, they treated with respect and with as good as they could. They fed us, they transported us, they clothed us. They even gave us Russian uniforms so that we would have clean clothes. And really, I have no complaints about them. They are wonderful people. You can't judge the government with the people. Right. They love their country, Mother Russia. They would, and they did give their life. 40 million Russians perished in that war. And they really fought the lions. And if the Russians wouldn't have this second front, the war would have lasted many, many more years. So I'm really very, very grateful to the Russians for fighting and helping us to win the war.
This is Women's Focus that you're listening to. My name is Carol Boss, and with me is Eva Schloss and Susan Pearson from the University of New Mexico Department of Theater and Dance. And Eva is very graciously sharing the stories of her harrowing, unbelievable journey to Auschwitz and now back again. I don't know how one then comprehends and processes what has happened. And it's not like you open a bottle of champagne and say, hey, we're free. The horrors are, you know, are still with you as you leave the camp. You see it all through the countryside. So your mother and you were together, and we went to
Katowice and Czernowitz, and eventually we ended up in Odessa on the Black Sea. And there we were billeted into a big empty building, and we waited then really for the end of the war. And all the time new transports came from liberated parts, prisoners of war as well. It was a very international camp. In a way, it was sort of a camp. And something which was very painful again, you know, the Red Cross sent food parcels and clothes to the prisoners of war, but we didn't get anything. And that was as well something really bad, you know, that the Red Cross never went into the concentration camps. They went, of course, into the prisoners of war camp and supervised that the people were treated according to the Geneva Convention, but for the camps, they just ignored us completely. And later we heard that the head of the Red Cross in Switzerland was a great admirer of Hitler and was a Nazi.
Well, you finally got back to Amsterdam, right, after being in...
After about 6 months traveling.
And at that point you went to university.
No, I was just 16.
Oh, you were still just 16. That's right, right,
right. I was 16. I went back to school. I didn't want to go because I felt I was an adult after all this experience.
Yes.
But it was Otto Frank who had come to our house very often, and he told my mother, you must insist that Eva goes back to school because a good education is something nobody can take away from her. So I went back to school, but I was very miserable. And then, of course, we heard the news of my father and brother who had perished in Mauthausen, an Austrian concentration camp, several days before the American army came to liberate that camp. So that was for us, you know, really the worst.
That's too much.
Our own suffering, we got over that. But the loss of your family like this, in this unknown way, and I didn't believe it. You know, as I said, my father was such a strong person. I said, well, if I have survived, he must have survived. And many, many people did turn up after many months, even after years. They were ill. They were in displaced people camps in Germany. Some had been even taken to Russia and came back after many years. So always when a car pulled up outside, I ran to the window and I thought, that must be my father, my brother coming back. So that made it even more difficult to accept it. And I heard that was the same with September 11, when people went to work and didn't turn up, and there was nothing found from them. People just couldn't accept it that they really perished. So, and there was no counseling, that didn't exist at that time. So it was really hard. And then when I wanted to talk about it, people didn't want to listen, didn't want to hear. So I had to suppress it. And again, this was very, very difficult.
So when
I just lived with it for many, many years.
So when you went back to school, were there any classmates who had been in the same situation as you?
You know, I met a few years ago a young man, well, he wasn't a young, who I went to school with then after the war, and we talked, and I said, you know, I didn't know you had come back from Auschwitz, and he had been in a camp. We didn't know about it. There was one girl called Eva as well, who had been in Indonesia in a concentration camp by the Japanese. And she was in my class, and she was really the only friend I made because we knew of each other, that we had been through a similar experience.
So I know you started the university, and then you took yourself to London.
Yeah, I was unhappy in Holland, and so it was Otto Frank again. And my mother decided I should become a photographer. She had become very friendly, and they went to the Jewish Liberal Synagogue, which was formed, and they helped there. And my mother took Otto to lectures, and of course, a publication of the diary. Otto discussed everything with my mother. And Otto knew somebody in London who had a photographic studio. And he said, well, you can go there for a year to become an apprentice. So I did that. And I loved London. So it was a great difference to live in a country who was occupied by the Nazis or who just fought the war. I mean, England was bombed, especially London was much more than Holland, but people had never felt the occupation of a foreign army. And so people felt much more cheerful. There was a good atmosphere of they've won the war, they're going to rebuild, and the past was the past. So I worked with lots of young people there, and I wouldn't say I was happy, but I got a bit out of this depressing atmosphere which was in Holland. And I lived in a boarding house where there was a young man who had come from Israel to study economics. And we were all very poor, you know. We earned a couple of pounds, so nobody had money to go, not even to the movies. So we went on long walks together because at that time, English people didn't like foreigners. You were a bloody foreigner. So I was friendly with this foreigner as well. And so after 6 months, he said to me, Eva, I've fallen in love with you. Let's get married and start a new life in Israel.
And tell us his name?
Zvi Schloss.
And you know what? It just so happens Zvi is in the studio with us. And what's that?
He's coughing away.
Yes, if you hear a cough in the background, that's him.
And anyway, I said, no way. I won't marry you because I'm here just for a year. And I have to go back to my mother. I couldn't imagine I would leave her alone. And then one day, Otto Frank came to visit, and I told him that. And he said, you know, your mother and me have fallen in love as well. And when you are settled, we like to get married. So this is what happened. We got married in 1952, and Otto and my mother got married in 1953.
Yeah,
so was a happier part of the story.
It's definitely a happier part of the story. And I know before we came in here to be in the studio and do the show, you were mentioning Otto Frank really had a huge influence on you. Well, he was a big part of your life. You and your husband had children, and now you have grandchildren, but that Otto was like a grandfather.
He was a wonderful grandfather to our three daughters.
Right. But in terms of having the will to go on. I know there had to have been bitterness. Did you have bitterness and anger when you?
Oh, very much so, very much so. I didn't trust anybody because we had been betrayed and I'd been put down, you know, for many years. I was only 9 when that started. And so when I was growing up and I was supposed to get self-confidence in myself, I didn't have that because I was persecuted by everybody. So, I was very unsure of myself, but Otto helped me a lot. He was really a wonderful person. And in the diaries, I can see the philosophy and the humanity of Otto. He must have given that to Anna when she grew up. And they were in hiding as well, 2 years, of course. And he taught her everything. They were the whole day together, and they read books together. Otto did all kind of different archaeology, Greek history with her. And, you know, you can see that she was a humanist.
Humanist, right.
And that was Otto was as well.
And really, your mother worked with Otto, and because one of the things that kept Otto together was the discovery of Anne's diary, and then having that published, and there being worldwide interest in it. And your partner, and it sounds like your mother, from what I read, was a real partner in that.
They did everything together. And actually, in the last pages of Anne, of her diary, which was kept out of the diary which Otto published, Anne described the bad marriage of her parents. And but Otto had found his love really with my mother. Uh-huh. They were really extremely happy. For me, it was sometimes a bit difficult because I adored my father, and my mother had a very happy marriage with my father. And I questioned my mother. I said, how can you be happy with a man who is not the father of your children and with whom you were so happy? And my mother explained that when I was young, your father was an excited man. He was the boss. He did everything, you know, how he wanted it. And I adored him. But with Otto, now that I'm older and have gone through much, we discuss everything. It's I know exactly what is going to happen. We are partners. And it's much more tranquil. And so she said it was really an ideal. When I was young, I had this excited marriage, and now that I'm older, I have this wonderful partnership. And I understood that. But what was as well, you know, why I wrote my second book, The Promise, when my brother, he was an artist, even as a young boy. He was a wonderful musician. And later, when he was in hiding, he created amazing paintings, and he wrote poetry, and he taught himself six languages, and like any very sensitive person, he was very much afraid of dying. And when he was 12, he asked my father once, what will happen when we die? And my father said, well, if you have children, you will live on in your children. And then this 12-year-old boy said, but what if I die before I have any children? And my father said, we are all a link in a big chain, and that can never be broken. It goes from generation to generation. And whatever you have done in your life, somebody will remember. And so your spirit, your body will, of course, go, but your spirit will live on. And Anne said as well, when she dies, she would like to live on. And very often my mother and me said, what about poor Heinz? He's forgotten by the world. And through this play, you know, I share his life with thousands of audiences all over the world. And I feel I've kept the promise which my father gave to my brother that he will be remembered. And this is my book, The Promise, as well, partly about our relationship with my brother.
Right. And, you know, you had, back probably in the 80s it was, gotten involved with Holocaust education. And it sounds like you've been speaking to groups. You've been speaking to young people all over the world.
That's right.
And you've been on a mission. So it's really, in so many ways, a beautiful story of a transformation of sorrow and grief and tremendous loss into one of a woman who's on a mission and truly wants to make
a difference.
Yeah.
And I'm a very happy person now.
You've had a wonderful life.
I had a very interesting life. I met some wonderful people, and I appreciate life because I realized I could not have experienced all this. I could have been killed like Anne or my brother when we were young teenagers.
And I imagine you learn to appreciate the beauty in many things, from moment to moment, day to day.
Exactly.
Eva, you're very skilled at bringing it all to closure. I was thinking, oh, I have so many more things to ask Eva, but you know, you just brought it to a perfect closure.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you so much for being here. This is really very, very special. And I want to I want us to talk about the production again. And Then They Came For Me, Remembering the World of Anne Frank. It's directed by Susan Pearson, who is with the University of New Mexico Department of Theater and Dance. And Susan, take it away.
If you wouldn't mind,
no, of course not.
Because we've had so much recent snow and this play is really for young people. We had scheduled two school matinees, and because of all the snow days, several had to cancel, and there are still a limited number of seats available for two special matinees that are not open to the public. And if I could give an email address, if there are any homeschoolers or people out there who would like to bring young people, this is really geared for ages 10 and up, they can email Kathleen Clawson, KCLAWSON, at unm.edu for more information about that.
Do you want to give the times of the remaining?
The performances remaining are this tonight at 7:30, Sunday at 2, and then next week, the Thursday, Friday, and Saturday at 7:30, and Sunday at 2. And they All can right. go to they can call 925-5858, which is the UNM ticket office number, which is probably even better than the department number.
So, Eva, thank you, Susan. This is either terrible of me as an interviewer, but it's very typical of me, or it may be good. In a lot of cases, it's good. I'll always say, oh, but I have one more question. And this is a very big question, so we don't have to make it a very big answer, but how do you feel in terms of this world and what is going on? There is so much tragedy. There is so much genocide, which a lot of people, like people who did not, you know, we talk about it, and then they came for me, and that comes from a very famous poem. You know, first they came for the Jews, and nobody spoke
Pastor
up.
Pastor Niemöller, yes.
Yes, and then they came for the communists, but yes. Nobody spoke up.
That's correct, yeah.
And then there was no one left.
To speak up for
him.
For
me, you know, yeah, right. So there were people who, you know, there are many people who felt that the Holocaust could have been actually avoided. If there are other countries and more people speaking up, and this kind of thing is happening around the world, there is now much more awareness growing about genocide, like in the Sudan, for example, and other countries as well. What do you think about, and I know this is a loaded question, it's a comprehensive, it could be a comprehensive answer, but basically, do you feel that there is hope in terms of the awareness growing that this will ever stop?
Well, certainly, as I say, I'm an optimist, and I think we have progressed. I mean, certainly, for instance, in America, that you have a black president, which is something which one couldn't have imagined a few years ago. And in South Africa, that apartheid has fallen. And without a bloodbath, this was an amazing event as well. And I think we are making progress, but I think we have a long way to go still. And the only way which we can change this is through the attitude of people to accept each other, because this is really the base of all this evil, the prejudice against other people who are different from ourselves. So once, and I think now, in England, but I think here as well, we have going to schools where we have people from children from 40 different countries, and they mix. And in the street, you see a lot of intermarriages with Oriental people, with black people. And I hope eventually we'll really be one big people in the world. Completely mixed, you know, all this will go white or black or green or yellow, whatever. You know, we'll be one people and we'll accept our different religions, because religion, unfortunately, has been a stumble block as well and the cause for genocides. But because basically it all comes down very much to the same. Religion is basically the same: to become decent people, look after each other, and live in harmony.
Thank you very much, Eva Schloss. Thanks for being here, and Susan Pearson.
Thank you.
Thank you.
It's really a pleasure to meet you.